Chapter 13, The Day Draws Near. In the spring of 2003, on May 21st, John Paul held an audience and departed from his text. Lately, he had often been departing from his text, but this day it was startling, for he bluntly told the gathered crowd in St. Peter Square that, quote, "the day is drawing near." He would soon, he said, face his Maker and have to account for his life. Well, this gave some people in the crowd and some who would later read of his comments a bit of a shudder. If he's worried about his accounts, how worried should I be? But the Pope didn't seem worried, he just seemed serious. It seemed to me, when I read the story and saw the pictures of the event days later, that he was preparing people for his leaving. This is something he'd taken to doing quite a lot. Why prepare them at all? Previous popes had aged and bowed to illness without telling people that they were leaving. What was he up to? What did he want us to know? Well, we know that endings were on his mind. A few weeks before, on Saturday, March 1st, John Paul had done something else surprising. He spoke in public to strangers about his past. He did it in a strong voice, ad-libbing, and he seemed to be having a good time. When his aides tried to shuffle him off, he moved his head as if to say, "My handlers want me to move on, but not just yet." It was a Vatican meeting with seminarians who were studying throughout the world for the priesthood. The Pope had completed a standard address in which he told the young men it would take courage for them to embrace their vocation. Then he spoke spontaneously about his youth in Poland during World War II. He put down his prepared speech. He told the young seminarians what it was like for him to study in secret and under pain of arrest or death for the priesthood. The place and time he was referring to, Poland, circa 1939-1945, can probably best be understood as the funnel through which the 20th century poured its woes. The Pope and his nation had lived through a brutal Nazi invasion in 1939, when he was still a teenager. Throughout much of the occupation that followed, the troops of the Soviet Union waited, massed on the shores of a river, ready to descend when the day came that the Nazis would be defeated and withdraw. The people of Poland were as abused as any in history. Hounded, starved, imprisoned, murdered, sent to death camps. The Pope was then a young chemical factory worker studying for the priesthood in secrecy. He and the good priests who taught him would have been killed if they had been discovered. The Nazis did not want more Catholic priests and had nailed the doors of the seminaries shut. The Soviets wouldn't want more priests either. John Paul had spoken of those years to biographers, but he didn't do it often in public, and he hadn't done so in a very long time. The fact that he did in the spring of 2003, spontaneously, in St. Peter's Square, and with what the Associated Press later called a vigor now rarely seen in public, seemed meaningful. For about 10 minutes, the Pope told the seminarians arrayed before him of his youth. He felt called to the priesthood, he said, and so he took instruction in the cellar of a nearby church. But he continued to work his shifts at the factory, and it was all very difficult for him. However, said the Pope, his co-workers at the factory, rough Polish men living lives as stressed as his own, helped him with his religious education by trading shifts with him and occasionally covering for him. And they did this at their peril. He learned his faith, he said, in those terrible years of war and clandestinity. John Paul told the seminarians how much he owed his co-workers. He brought his books to the factory, he said, and they helped him keep his studies secret. In those days, he was studying Christian metaphysics. His reading gave him a new vision of the world, he said, a new profound penetration of reality. Then he told the crowd what he thought of it all now, so many years later. He said he thanked God for those days. He said, I thank the Lord who gave me this extraordinary experience and who let me speak of this experience as a clandestine seminarian to seminarians in Rome after more than 50 years. He thanked God for the pain that had deepened his understanding of life and that had been followed by joy. Then one of John Paul's aides came forward and whispered in his ear, and John Paul laughed and told the young men gathered before him that he had to give them their blessings now. There were things to do, he said, a schedule to be maintained. The young seminarians left, departing emotionally, it was reported, moved by what the Pope had said to them and how he had said it. At this time, it turned out that the Pope had also been writing poetry again. He had been a published poet before his papacy, but he hadn't written much poetry since, or any that anyone knew of. Now, all of a sudden, we learned that he had returned to writing in the summer of 2002. There was an autumnal quality to the work. The Pope had referred in private meetings in the previous few years to his passing, but even sophisticated Vatican observers were taken aback by the long poem he had written in Castel Gandolfo. It was called Roman Triptych. In the second part of the poem, called Meditations on the Book of Genesis at the Threshold of the Sistine Chapel, John Paul reflected on the day he was elected pope by the cardinals of the church. He referred to the inevitable choosing of his successor, and he said the great cardinals of the church would be called from each corner of the earth and would come together once again under the frescoes of Michelangelo, beneath his masterpiece, The Creation, and beneath his other masterpiece, The Last Judgment. In the poem, the pope imagined the day when his successor would be chosen. He wrote, "So it will be again when the need arises after my death. Michelangelo's vision must then speak to them. They will find themselves between the beginning and the end, between the day of creation and the day of judgment. It is given to man once to die, and after that, the judgment." He was speaking both literally and metaphorically. The College of Cardinals do meet under Michelangelo's great frescoes when a pope dies, but the poem also made one curious. What did Michelangelo's vision speak to John Paul himself when he was the cardinal from Krakow and attending two papal enclaves, the one that picked John Paul I and the one that picked him? What thoughts had he had as he looked up at Michelangelo's work? In the days immediately before and after his speech to the seminarians, John Paul had been busy. His actions suggested his thoughts continued to be on world conflict, but not the conflicts of the past in his homeland. What seemed to press on him now were the conflicts that were roiling the world in his old age. He had launched a campaign to include references to the reality of God in the new proposed constitution of the European Union, asking that it include an acknowledgement of the role of the Christian Church on the continent of Europe since the very death of Christ. He reached out for an ally in the Greek Orthodox Archbishop, telling him that day by day, to his dismay, Europe was growing all the more worldly and secular and continues to distance itself from basic Christian values. He received the Orthodox Archbishop's support. John Paul then reached out to Serbian Orthodox leaders, and they too supported him, agreeing it was wrong to exclude from New Europe's founding document the crucial importance of faith in the continent's history. And the Pope met with Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain in a private audience in which he told Blair, whose wife and children are Catholic, and who has long been rumored to be considering joining the Roman Church, that Christianity must not be ignored or forgotten in the EU Constitution. But it appeared John Paul was fighting a losing battle. The bureaucrats of Brussels, where the EU Constitution was being drafted, and their like-minded diplomatic associates in the member states of the EU were not interested in including references to God in their great document. This must have been painful for John Paul, painful in itself, and painful in what it represented. The sense, documented by statistics on mass attendance, church going, church involvement, religious practice, lifestyle, that Catholic Europe, during John Paul's reign, had become post-Christian Europe. The great Catholic writer Hilaire Belloc had said at the beginning of the 20th century, "Europe is the faith, and the faith is Europe." That was actually still true then. It is not true now. You can walk the streets of Paris at Christmas time, as I have, and you wouldn't know it was a great Christian holiday if you didn't have a calendar in your hand. You can walk the streets of Dublin, on a Sunday morning and see more people at brunch than in church. There are those who argue that this is John Paul's fault, or at least responsibility. In American conservative Catholic circles, they sometimes say, "On his watch, we lost Europe." But that is foolish. It wasn't his fault. It was his grief. And I wonder what he would have thought, how he would have reacted, if he had lived 2 months longer and seen, in the late spring of 2005, the people of France and the people of the Netherlands amaze the world by voting against the European Constitution. There is no sign they did it for reasons the Pope would have found especially heartening, and yet he had perhaps contributed to an on-the-ground sense in Europe that the new proposed constitution was just not a plus. To my mind, two huge things happened in Europe in the 20th century that changed its very essence, its shared culture, its assumptions, its understanding of life. The first was, obviously, the cataclysm of World War I, which robbed Western Europe of a generation of young men. They had marched out under flags and crucifixes, and they had never come back. And that huge and historic trauma broke something in Europe's spirit that has not been healed. When you lose a generation, you lose a future, and you lose hope. Cynicism settled in, and sourness about great projects and their cost. France was a brave country until the end of World War I, and then they never wanted to fight for anything ever again. Then World War II, of course, more carnage and ruin and genocide. The second thing that happened to Europe took place later in the 20th century, and I think it was the rise of modernity, of broad, growing, and then historic affluence, the rise of the material world and its distractions and glittering prizes, the possibility of living lives that were in central ways more detached from life, from its sunrise demands and muddy miseries and plain joys, the rise of the isms, socialism, communism, Nazism, capitalism, the spread of Freudianism, the seeing of man as a psychological rather than a spiritual being. Any one of these would tend to detach some men from their faith. The confluence of all of them in roughly a 50-year period and after the trauma of two world wars destabilized the continent. And now came changing demographic patterns. Europeans, no longer Catholic, were not having enough children to replace themselves. The people of more crowded and less affluent Islam began coming in, and have been coming in for 30 years, and they are having babies. Could John Paul have changed all this? Could he have changed any of it? How? Ultimately, people change themselves. They have freedom. You cannot force them to change their minds. What John Paul could do is precisely what he did. Take the word of Jesus Christ compellingly through the streets of these countries. Go to these people, write to them, speak to them over the heads of the media and the heads of the culture, if you will. Urge people to consider God, embrace God, live as God asks. He prayed for them. He asked God to change their hearts. And he must have been frustrated by them. For there was always the sense with John Paul, when he spoke to the rich, when he spoke to the wealthy nations, that they did not, of all the people in the world, have the most direct access to his heart. He grew up in a country that was poor, that was bullied, and that was occupied by foreign armies. They didn't have religious freedom through most of his life. Didn't luxurious Western Europe understand what a gift it was to be able to practice your faith in public? Didn't they understand that others had fought for that gift and secured it for them? Poland knew how to suffer, and Poland knew how to pray. So does suffering Africa, so do the poor of the Americas and the Philippines. People who are so lucky they don't even think they have to pray. How could John Paul have not been frustrated by them? And yet, for all this, something happened at the beginning of the 21st century that showed us a different picture and that suggested that maybe, just maybe, John Paul was right in his decision to carry the gospel as he did. It was the first great moment of the 21st century, and it occurred when John Paul died at his funeral. Europe, as you know, came. Europe took to the streets. Millions of pilgrims spontaneously came to the funeral. You could see the signs they held as they stood in the famous line that stretched from St. Peter's across the Tiber. The signs that said Poland, England, France, Italy, Ireland. You could see it by the flags they waved, and you could see it when, at the funeral, the crowd burst into applause more than a dozen times and chanted Magnus, Magnus, the Great, the Great. That was Europe rising up and coming and weeping. That was Europe showing that there may be more going on in the European heart right now than statistics can quite express or reflect. One sensed that Europeans may, just may, have come back from that funeral a heartened people.